Welcome back to the listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio AM 820's special broadcast of the 2016 Catholic Social Services Poverty Summit, recorded on Tuesday, October 4th, 2016, the Feast of St. Francis of Assisi. In this hour, we have a panel discussion moderated by Lisa Schweitzer-Cortis, with panelists David Bianconi, Representative Michael Curtin, Michael Habish, and Rachel Lustig. Here's Lisa Schweitzer-Cortis. Enjoy.
About Lisa, and she said, no, this is what she wants you to know about her. She's been with the Columbus Foundation for 13 years, and as an example of a mixed income development, she is actually the chair of the Wyland Park Collaborative, which is a mixed income neighborhood. So go Columbus, right? We're doing it, right? So, Lisa.
We're going to plan to get out of here by noon, so I'm setting my alarm for 11:45, which will allow us time for you to ask questions of our panelists as well as Dr. Lupton. And do you not go by doctor?
I go by Bob usually.
Or Dr. Bob. I'm so glad to be here. Let me quickly introduce our panelists so we can get the discussion rolling. Dave Bianconi, raise your hand. Yay. Founded Progressive Medical in 1986 and served as its CEO until 2011. Under his leadership, he provided the vision and leadership that enabled Progressive Medical to develop innovative solutions that were all about the customers. He has been honored with several awards, noting his compassionate, integrity-driven business practices, most notably ranking in Inc.'s 500s Hall of Fame since 1999. Dave and his wife, Michelle, have four children and are active members of the Catholic Church in Columbus. In 2012, Representative Mike Curtin was elected to the House of Representatives for the 17th District, an area that covers much of West and South Columbus. He works tirelessly to promote civility and bipartisanship in an effort to address Ohio's problems. His term ends at the end of December, so if you need him now, you have a couple of months to call on him. He retired from the Dispatch Printing Company after a 38-year distinguished career as a reporter and retiring as vice chairman. And he was a friend and resource to all and continues to be. He's a native of Columbus, a graduate of Bishop Watterson High School, husband to Sharon for close to 40 years, and they have two children and grandchildren. Matt Habish, wait, raise your hand. There you go. Became executive director of the Mid-Ohio Food Bank in 1984 when he graduated from elementary school. Prior to that, he spent a couple of years at St. Stephen's. He was a member of City Council during this time from 1993 to 2006 and served as council president for seven of those years. He has two degrees from Xavier University and one from OSU. He has a local and national reputation as a significant change agent responsible for providing key leadership that has transformed our feeding systems. And I believe that he and his wife have a basketball team of grandchildren, like five girls. It's so fun. And finally, but not least, Rachel Lustig, who did a fabulous job this morning, thank you so much, is president and CEO, as you know, of Catholic Social Services. Prior to Columbus, she served at Catholic Charities USA as senior vice president of mission and ministry. Her experiences also include serving in a leadership role at an orphanage in Chile. As a Notre Dame graduate, she serves on many boards, including St. Charles. And she was recently selected one of the candidates for Business First 40 Under 40 and by the National Catholic Reporter as one of the 12 Catholic women under 40 making a difference. Are you still under 40?
Wow.
All right. So my first question is, which presidential candidate do you think would be best at reducing toxic charity? And that's rhetorical, so do not. So I thought it would be great if you could each share what resonated most with you this morning as you heard from Dr. Lupton. We'll start with Rachel.
Thank you, Lisa. It's great to be here, and thank you to be a part of this panel. It's kind of amazing and an honor. What resonated with me was the concept that there are no permanent givers and no permanent receivers of services. This morning I shared a little story of how much I had to learn from people who would have otherwise not have been considered incredible teachers, and the lessons that they've taught me have shaped my life. And so I am forever, thank you, grateful, sorry, forever grateful for that concept and that reminder that there are those among us who will always, who have so much to give.
Thank you. I think what resonated with me was, as a business owner, building a business and going through the process of all of the challenges that you have, solving problems, looking and identifying, playing root cause analysis, SWOT analysis, and all of that. And you look at what a lot of us that are not considered in poverty that looks at society, so many times it's easy for us to judge, and sometimes incorrectly, often incorrectly. And it was very refreshing. I heard Bob talk at the Columbus Foundation a while back, and I was just amazed at what he had to say. And I mean, it was a breath of fresh air. I'm honored to be on this panel with what's your name?
Who are you again?
Yeah, with everybody up here, and with Rachel and Mike and Matt, and looking forward to having a great conversation today.
Thank you, Lisa. There's much in Bob's work that resonates and much that clangs, in my opinion, much that I can readily agree with and much that I vociferously disagree with. But since we're starting with the upside, I will say the part that resonated most strongly flows from the time-honored proverb, you know, give a man to fish and you feed him for a day, teach a man to fish and you feed him for a lifetime. There's no one in this room who's going to disagree with that. So when Bob talks about it not being unloving to expect people to do their part and so forth and so on, absolutely, agree wholeheartedly. But I believe that he moves from personal experience and personal anecdote to make broad, sweeping generalizations that simply can't be supported, and I look forward to commenting on those downsides.
I think what resonated with me most was, I mean, when I started my career a long, long time ago at St. Stephen's Community House, John Maloney said the best social service program was a good-paying job with benefits. And that has stuck with me. So a lot of, I found probably your least controversial, the last 15 minutes, because I think this community has begun on a journey, whether it's Wyland Park, the South Side, the Thrive conversations, to really begin to start to understand what the upstream issues are that result in people showing up hungry and living still in poverty. And I think we're just at the beginning of some of that. Mixed neighborhoods, those kind of things are going on. But I think just to begin to say, we got to go upstream. I use a little different language. I say we'll never program ourselves out of poverty. Uses the word service. I absolutely believe that. So there's a lot in that I'd like to share.
So as I mentioned in my introduction of Matt, being a national thought leader around the feeding movement, and also question for Rachel, given that Catholic Social Services runs a food pantry as well. When I first met Matt, I believe you had under 50 employees, and the Great Recession came. And we stopped talking at one point when you had 100, not that we weren't talking anymore, but we didn't talk about how many employees he had. He said, this is going in the wrong direction. So what does this mean to you and your work as a national thought leader in the feeding movement? And how do you take some of these principles from Toxic Charity to advance the change in the feeding movement, and to Rachel as well?
I think the biggest thing is the data doesn't support some of what you heard. To give you an example, we started a software tracking system. So we can now track over 500,000 people that we touch in a year. 80% of those people come five times or less a year to a food pantry. This is across 20 counties, 10,000 square. Holds true for 13 other food banks that are using this software. So the language shift that I would suggest is, rather than emergency or chronic, it's episodic. Life happens to you and you need help. What's shifting for us, and where I think Bob's right, in the sense that we don't measure outputs. I could care less how many pounds of food, meals served, people served. What I now want to measure is the health impact, because what we have shifted to is a model that's about healthy food access, not food insecurity, not just finding food and getting it to people. That was the model that food banks were using. We've been leading an effort to talk about fresh food. There are 10 to 14 billion pounds of fresh produce left in the fields in the United States every year. And we got an issue that people don't have enough to eat. Charity only represents 5% of the total. So if you want to talk about changes, and there's a 10% gap, 85% comes from people's income and government support programs. Those government support programs stop at 130% with the exception of WIC. Most vulnerable people we're working with are people in the middle. They lose Medicaid, they lose food, they lose a lot of benefits, and we've got to address this, and it's a systemic issue based on income. The income mobility issue in this community is what we really need. That's beginning to go upstream. So for us, our model has shifted. We're the fifth largest produce distributing food bank in the United States. You know, one of my padres, a good friend of Bill Bowling, you know, I've known for 30-plus years, is the Atlanta Food Bank Director. We've really begun to say how he just retired. How do we shift the model to fresh food? Really, then, in partnership with the healthcare aid organizations, can we, in fact, measure the output of that? We've done that with diabetes, and we're continuing. So the whole model shifted for me.
There's no doubt in my mind that, Matt's on to something important, mentioning that the best way to get out of poverty is through a job, a stable job with benefits that pays you enough for to support yourself and your family. And I think that what we're interacting with is people who are struggling for a number of reasons to be in that place, whether it's health barriers or a lack of effective training to get to them to that role. In order to be able to make that transition, there's going to have to be some sort of stabilization in somebody's life. You know, in a very overly simplistic example, somebody paid for me to eat when I was in college. So I think what we're looking for in some of the social service environments is a real partnership between the sectors in order to be able to help people move out of poverty. One where we can create a level of stabilization and a commitment with people to imagine what's their future look like, and then a partnership to be able to get there. And that partnership's going to be multi-sector. It's going to be across several nonprofit agencies, and it's going to have to be the work of a community. But it'll involve a number of strategies along the spectrum of emergency assistance, the individual development, and the community development work.
And Dave, since you've gotten to know Dr. Lupton, how has it informed your and Michelle's philanthropy? Are you looking at philanthropy differently? Are you expecting different things from those organizations that you make grant investments with?
Well, I think more than anything else, it's reinforced our view of what we are finding out there. We're new, relatively new, and new every day exposes a new chapter of philanthropy to us. Very difficult to know who to support, and outcomes are very important. But one of the things I found recently was very eye-opening for me is that I was having lunch with Mike Davis of Junior Achievement. And many of you know Junior Achievement. It's a great organization. They do great things with young men and women. And I, during the lunch, I was asking Mike, I said, how can you get, we need to get everybody, every child through Junior Achievement. And he said, yeah, I know it's very difficult. And he said, it's like college. These kids don't think they can even go to college. And I said, how can they not think that they can go to college with all of the programs that are available to people today? And he asked me a very startling question, eye-opening question. He said, when you graduated from high school, did you apply to an Ivy League school? And I immediately got the connection. But my answer was no. And he asked, why not? And I said, I didn't apply to an Ivy League school because I didn't think I could go to an Ivy League school. And he said, why? He said, because I didn't know anyone that went to an Ivy League school. And he said, you know, your Ivy League school are the colleges and community colleges for the youth of today in the inner city. They just don't believe they can do this. And so more than the money, I mean, we have to be able to change the mindset of the young men and women to make them believe that they can do what they do not believe they can do. And so Bob is writing and talking about is really just supporting what we are becoming to find. And it is such a complicated issue. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've thought about this, and I know there's so many components of the equation. It's not just money is the least of it, actually, in my belief.
Thank you. Mike, very few people know our community as well as you do. When you think about the model that's been presented in Charity Detox and the challenge of outcomes versus activities, do you see potential for our community to rise to this occasion? And are there actual programs and organizations and leaders that you see putting this into place now?
Part of Bob's book, I believe, segment that he had, neighborhood idea, we used to have that. When I was growing up in the 50s and 60s, we had that. We lost it in the late 60s, 70s, and up until the present day. When I first started covering government, and I covered government for near 40 years, Dr. John H. Roseman, the first African-American elected to our Columbus City Council after it became an at-large council in 1914. He was elected in 1969. He lived in the hood. You know, he lived basically where he grew up. Dr. David Hamler, a dentist, elected to the Columbus Board of Education. He lived in the neighborhood. He lived in the hood. You look at these iconic African-American leaders, and it was true in the white community as well. I mean, they lived. I mean, you had doctors living next to sanitation workers, living next to librarians, living next to, auto workers. We don't have that today. We're so segregated by socioeconomic status everywhere that, I mean, I agree wholeheartedly with Bob, and I think we're beginning to see in our community and others the beginnings, the beginning efforts to figure out how to reinvent mixed-income neighborhoods. And before I give up the mic, my biggest criticism of the book it is full of broad, sweeping generalizations not supported by data, as Matt said. And as someone who respects government, and I'm not a government demonizer, he says this. It's on page 9 of Charity Detox, in agreement with Rick Warren, paraphrasing Rick Warren. Almost every government and non-government organization poverty program is actually harmful to the poor. Where's the data? In my business of journalism, you don't make a statement like that without giving some sort of reference for why you're making that type of indictment.
That was Rick Warren's
book. My response, and then I'll yield the floor, my response to that would be Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid all were founded and still are government anti-poverty programs. And they've been enormously successful in keeping millions and millions of Americans from living in poverty. And they're all income adjusted. I pay at the top rate for Medicare. I'm 65 this year. I'm now a Medicare beneficiary. I pay at the top rate. A lot of people pay very little to get the same benefits I have. And that's the beauty of America. And government made that happen. And I think, Bob, the book has a strong current of demonizing government, and I give many other examples if we had time, that's unjustified.
Would either or any of you like to respond to Mike?
I knew it.
A former elected official, I think we're in a what has to happen, and what we're trying to do with the Thrive conversation is realize it takes all three sectors. And we got to quit demonizing. You know, even in the world of the charity toxicity language, the charity is still there. If I'm understanding correctly, most of the food for your co-op still comes from the food bank. They've got to find it. They've got to get it and do that. Most of the clothes, all probably, I assume the clothes in your clothing store, you know, is charity. That's how it got there. It's the you've changed the model for distributing it. You know, that's what you've done. We got to recognize, I talk in terms of government, SNAP program. How many people pillar the food stamp program? That's what SNAP is, if you don't know that. It actually is an amazing program to give people the resources to go in the grocery store and buy their own food. Yet I say we win when that program, like WIC, gets viewed as a health program and not as an entitlement program.
One of the things, I've been in this community 3 years, so I can't speak from the heritage that many around the table can. But what I noticed when I stepped in is that there are a couple of systems within this community that are working very well. I believe that the senior service system is working very well. I think we've got a good homeless shelter system that works together and is coordinated. And what Matt's able to do by bringing our food pantries together is phenomenal. So much of that is a function of government, where government's working seamlessly alongside. Where I think we run into trouble is where that system isn't strong enough. And unfortunately, a lot of that's happening for our children and our families, where the system is too fragmented. And it's what's ironic about that is that for the senior services, for the most part, we hope that they're going to continue on in the same trajectory. But what we're asking of our families and what we're requiring in the situation is that they change, is that they have some sort of life situation that alters, and we're not there in that same level of support. And so that's just one of the systems or one of the instances that I see coming in, and it's a lot of nonprofits and government and schools and trying, but it's just a little bit too fragmented to be able to be there. And consequently, we end up treating people like the problems that they present when they come to the agency, as opposed to the individuals, families, and neighborhood units that they represent. And I think that that's going to be one of our challenges as we want to see people be successful in today's environment, is creating that system of support that's out of who their true experience is as an individual and family unit.
At the break, Kim Inch, who is here from Sun Ministries, she's right in front of me, she said, I think we do have mixed income neighborhoods and they're in the suburbs. What is your response to Kim's insight?
Well, in some of our older neighborhoods, we do. I live in the Grandview Heights area, and Grandview Heights was incorporated in the 20s. You know, there is a lot of diversity in Grandview Heights. There's more diversity in Upper Arlington than people would think. You know, there's Upper Arlington, and there's Lower Upper Arlington, and there's East Upper Arlington and West Upper Arlington. And in Grandview, there's above the hill and below the hill. Those sorts of things. If you go to Bexley, you know, you can buy a $3 million home, or you can buy a $300,000 home. I mean, that's mixed income. It's upper-end mixed income, but it's mixed income. So there are many mixed-income neighborhoods in Columbus and Franklin County, but not in the poorest of the poor areas. You know, you don't find too much mixed income in Linden. You don't find too much mixed income in the Hilltop that I serve in the house. You don't find too much mixed income on the near south side, except where Children's Hospital has made a major impact moving south along Parsons Avenue. We have a lot of work to do in the poorest areas of our community.
Other quick thought. I spent 14 years getting pillared at City Hall for every zoning issue that came before us because everybody wanted the next subdivision next to them to be bigger and more expensive than theirs, so their housing values. The suburban model that was created after World War II of cul-de-sacs and suburbia and concentric circles away from industry to commercial to apartments to single family to McMansions, that was the model that was created. And the reality of it is, when I ask people what the best neighborhoods in Columbus, they start naming the ones that Mike just named. They're all mixed communities. And we've got to get back to that. I'd also say with regard to poverty in the suburbs, most everybody equates that to the 2007-08 era because of a lot of housing and things that happened. The reality of it is, from probably the 90s on, The Comprehensive Housing Affordability Strategy said disperse poor people. If you got more than 30% of people that are really poor living in a census tract, your chances of turning it to build the economics don't work. And so housing projects came down or got thinned out, and we started building apartment complexes all around the Outer Belt where the jobs were. So we moved people out there, but we didn't connect them to service and to transportation issues. So we only solved part of the problem when we did that. But we still didn't break down. I think a tenet that I would agree with Bob on, that I think also Robert Putnam, who was here a while back with the Columbus Foundation, he made the statement that you'll never marry somebody from the other side of the tracks because you'll never meet them. That's the reality. If we don't break down and build mixed neighborhoods so that, you know, I was blessed. My kids went to Linden Park IGE school, which was an amazing school, and my kids are now in their 30s, we're young. Lived in, you know, in South Linden, saw what was going on. It was just an amazing experience for my kids to grow up in that environment. We've got to get back.
You're listening to the panel discussion from the 2016 Catholic Social Services Poverty Summit here on St. Gabriel Catholic Radio, AM 820.
Is the life expectancy differential by zip code. That if you're growing old in the Worthington area, you're likely to live 84 years. If you're growing old in the Franklinton area, the average life expectancy is 64 years, a full 20-year difference within Franklin County. Both Mike and Matt and Bob are talking about this. I mean, we don't interact with each other in the way that we used to. And if we look at the political environment, we don't talk to each other the way that we used to, or the way that we could, in a way that's respectful. I loved what the Columbus Foundation just did a couple of months ago. No agenda. Let's sit down and let's call at the big table and let's have a conversation. And that kind of movement, this kind of disagreeing about what topics are with the goal to end poverty, is, I think, going to be the most fruitful part of the discussion. And if we can do it with people whose backgrounds and perspectives are different than ours, then I think we're going to be that much better off in the future.
My alarm is going to ring in a minute, but I want to ask Dave. It's interesting to hear a reporter and a former councilman, food bank guru, really challenged by what Bob has said today. But we have seen at the Columbus Foundation, our philanthropist and our donor family really moved by his work. And so, what is your reaction to that dichotomy?
Well, I think that most of the donors at the Columbus Foundation, we all come from a different perspective, probably. And as I mentioned earlier, one of measurements of our activities, return on investments. And so I think that those of us, many of us who have donor advised funds at the Columbus Foundation and other organizations, look at things. When we hear Bob talk about the things that he's talking about, while I will agree with Mike, for instance, that it's not a one solution for everything, but I think it's kind of like the pendulum, where somebody needs to start talking about these types of things, not as a total indictment of what the government does, because the government certainly has a hand, and there are certain things that only the government can do. But there are other things that, in a non-governmental arena, that those of us with donor-advised funds, I can tell you, when I talk to other donors, like Michelle and I, who have funds, and I talk to them about supporting various things that we've been involved in, they all want to know, what are the outcomes? You know, what if we're going to provide money to these institutions and organizations, what are the outcomes? And I tell people, money is the easiest part of that equation. The money is the easiest part of the equation. The most difficult part is people and processes, and are we doing good? And so that's been our experience in the situation.
Let us know your questions.
Where does violence and gun violence and domestic violence and all of those things fit into this equation with poverty, and what do we have a responsibility to do in terms of mitigating some of the violence that are in these very poor neighborhoods? And any of you can jump in.
One of the most interesting pieces of literature I'm seeing right now is about a psychology of scarcity. What the impact is on one's psyche to constantly be in a state of lacking the most fundamental of basic needs, resources. And I think what it's helping us to do is unpack what might be going on in someone's mind who doesn't have enough food to put on their table for their kids. The work of transitioning people out of poverty can't ignore mental health, it can't ignore addiction, and it can't ignore violence. And I think one of the great works that the Kerwin Institute is doing is looking at some of our opportunity zones in around the city and saying, how are we seeing a confluence of these factors, and how do we go and create some level of stability for people so that they can address the concerns that they have that are causing some of those eruptions?
You know, I would say, to me, one of the biggest threat is the absence of faith and prayer in the community. It's almost, the pendulum has swung so far to one side now that it's almost so negative for you to be faithful. I had heard a story of a Chinese economist that came over to the United States for a seminar, and he spoke to one of his colleagues, and his colleagues asked him, he says, was there anything about this country that was surprising to you? And his response was that, he says, yes, he says, I didn't realize the effect that your churches have had on your society. And he said, what do you mean by that? He says, well, it's obvious to me that from the time the founding fathers came here that your faith is heavily indoctrinated into your laws and your culture. He says, and it's really been the pastors and the rabbis and the preachers who have indoctrinated, along with the mothers and fathers of the children, who have indoctrinated the morals between what is right and what is wrong. He says, your country is based on the laws of voluntary adherence to those laws. He says, that voluntary adherence has come from your pastors, your preachers, your parents who have taught right from wrong. If you were to take away the churches and the pastors and the preachers and the mothers and fathers who teach that, he says, you can't possibly hire enough policemen to guard and to make this country safe. So to me, that is probably the biggest threat that I see. And as you know, you can't go around hitting people over the head and tell them that this is what you must believe. But we are always been taught, and I think you know, Jesus teaches us to do it with love and kindness, and good things will happen.
You're listening to the panel discussion from the 2016 Catholic Social Services Poverty Summit. Here on St. Gabriel Catholic Radio, AM 820.
Time still am. One of the interesting catch-22s for me is that you know in the last 20 to 25 years we've had largely unregulated gun sales. Anybody who wants a gun can get a gun. That's not our history. And the Second Amendment was never interpreted as carte blanche. Anybody who wants a gun, even mentally ill, you know, can go get one. It was always regulated. But in the last 20 to 25 years, it's been pretty much a Wild West atmosphere. Even though public opinion surveys show that between 90 and 95% of Americans support background checks. We don't have a working system of background checks, and that's one reason we have a flood of guns on our street. Anybody who wants one can easily get one. I'm not a natural pessimist. I'm a natural optimist. I think we're going to solve this problem eventually in enough election cycles because we'll have to. Currently we have the NRA, a very powerful group, which is representing the gun manufacturers, not the gun owners, in my view, running TV ads saying if a certain candidate gets elected president, the government's coming for your guns. You can believe that if you want to believe that. We'll get past that, and we'll get to a point where there will be, as the U.S. Supreme Court has said, it's a legitimate role for government to regulate every right you have, including the Second Amendment right. Not to come and take your gun, but to regulate how we acquire those guns and how much firepower one can have in one's home. We will get to a point in the not-too-distant future where we have some common-sense gun regulation policy where our streets are not flooded with guns.
Just real quick, I think from Ann, because I would wholeheartedly endorse that, I think we've got to seriously address the root causes of poverty. At the basis of the violence is poverty. You know, and we think, we like to believe everybody has an equal chance in this country, but when you study Kerwin's information on redlining in this community, you know, which was a 100-year policy of the federal government for segregation, when you look at that data, the only neighborhood, it's a reverse T of poverty, when you map, heat map it, the only neighborhood that's come out of that is the Short North. Every other neighborhood, so everybody born into those zip codes, to Rachel's point, you know, are starting at a huge disadvantage. And violence is what they know. The, right next to the Reeb School, where we run a market and a cafe and all those things that you know we do, the youth violence there for 8 to 14-year-olds is off the charts. So we're over here thinking, we're going to worry about third-grade reading? These kids are worried about staying alive. Either getting inducted into gangs and having to commit violence, or they're being perpetrated on. We've got to address, we got to make those kids feel safe so they even have a chance in school. They go into school stressed like that, they're done. And I think there's a lot of medical history on all of that. So for me, it's about going back and really being willing to examine the root causes and the income issues in this country, the vast separation, the wealth issue, all of those things. $15 an hour. Every time we talk about going to 10 or 15, we say we can't afford it to raise prices. Every time we give out multi-million dollar bonuses and everything else to the top, we don't have that conversation. We don't say, I'd love to give you a raise, you deserve it, but we can't afford it or raise prices. But we do it at the bottom, automatically. We need to be looking at the whole thing. That's when I think we can begin. And we got to deal with racism. That's my final point.
I'm glad you mentioned the Reeb Center. Could you explain to those who don't know what that is, just the impact it's having and how wonderful it is?
Very quickly, we had a Southside Settlement House closed a number of years ago. The Mayor Coleman at that time made a commitment to do something about that because we had this, you know, very long history, you know, place-based, you know, agency doing good work. And so a number of people, private donors, came together. Kelly's, the Grody's, I'm going to forget some, the Cranes, et cetera, came together along with government, city and the state, and said we can do something. The most amazing thing is Reeb was an iconic old school. No graffiti, no broken windows for years that it was vacant. The community, this was their space. So it became the hub of hope is what they named it. We got invited in very late. There are nonprofits in that space. We're going to have to go through a transition period of co-locating, which is what we're doing right now. We've been there a year, to collaborating to true community input, output, and action. It really is about that. We got to go through. That's a learning process for all of us. Something Rachel said I think is real important. We really have got to come together, and nonprofits don't do that well. We're not doing that well as society. We need to do that. Last point I would say to you, it all works because we suspended judgment going into that space. We're just there to work with the people and create opportunity.
So some people in the room here know that I've led corporate philanthropy for probably the second largest donor company in Central Ohio for 8 years. And over that 8 years, here's what I've seen. Matt, we have substantially increased our support of the Mid-Ohio Food Bank, and we have seen you go from, you know, a relatively modest operation on the west side of Columbus and Franklin area to the huge facility you have in Grove City, and it is bursting at the seams. A couple of years ago, 2-3 years ago, the Community Shelter Board said, we're going to build a new shelter and we're going to solve homelessness. No one's going to be without a bed. And today, it's oversubscribed. And if you're a homeless man on the streets today, you don't have a bed. How do we end this? You know, we have seen our gifts go from the tens to hundreds of thousands to the millions of dollars a year to address this issue. When we go back to the issue of outcomes, we're not solving it. It's only gotten worse. So here's my challenge to the panel. We've got to change it. What's the one thing we start doing tomorrow different from what we've been doing? Because otherwise, we're just insane. If we continue to do the same things, expect a different outcome.
Hello. In my opinion, We have to somehow get the family back together. You know, I heard statistics that as high as I heard something like 45% of children born across all sectors are born into without a father figure in the home. That's almost an impossible situation to sustain. With the family, I mean, many of us, you know, we weren't all born with silver spoons in our mouths. And we all came from, many of us here came from very, if not all of us, came from very humble beginnings. No air conditioning, no radio, one slice of pizza at night. And we were certainly on the financial ladder. We would, and many of you would be defined as in the poverty sector. But none of us thought we were poor. None of us felt that we were in poverty because we had a strong family unit that supported us in all of these capacities. And so in my opinion, unless we can fix that, I don't have an answer for that because, you know, we live in a society that says, do what you want to do and don't tell me what to do. I don't want to tell you to do what you should do, so no one can tell me what I should do. So you do what you want for your life, which is not good for everyone. So I think until we fix the family and that unit, I think we're going to continue to struggle.
Agree with that. I would also say this. In Bob's presentation, he asked the rhetorical question, why are the poor becoming poorer? And his answer was that our charity does more harm than good. It creates more dependency. More dependency feeds more dependency. I would counter with this. From 1980 to 2005, more than 80% of the total increase in national income went to the top 1% of earners. 80% of increase in income from 1980 to 2005 went to the top 1%. There is no amount of charity that would ever, ever compensate for that type of structural imbalance in our society. Bob's book, Charity Detox, both calls for a living wage. I agree with that. But it also opposes government-dictated minimum wages. We are the government. Government is not over there somewhere. We collectively are the government. We set the moral tone, and we set the moral standards, and we communicate to our elected officials what we expect. The minimum wage needs to be a living wage. We exempt small employers under the amount of annual revenue. That's appropriate. We have to make these judgment calls. They're tough judgment calls, but we have to increase living wages. We have to increase minimum wages in our country. That will do more than all the charity can possibly do in this country.
I'd just add to that real quick. I think a couple thoughts real quick in terms of things that we have to do. We've got to have that conversation. I can tell you it's doable. You know, Lisa mentioned we had 50 employees. I now have 140 employees. 2 years ago, I went to $15 an hour. You know, and we did it. We paid for it in 9 months, you know, with less turnover, you know, and less training costs, et cetera. You know, we've seen employers do that. Nationwide has done that. There are others that are starting to do that. We've got to take that issue on and say, look, you put more buying power in people's hands. They're consumers. They buy more. It works. I think that process works better than trickle-down economics, and that's what we've tried to keep. That failed experiment keeps going on. So I would suggest we do that. The second thing, and I think probably for us, it's yes and thinking. You know, we keep getting into either or scarcity thinking. I live in a world of abundance thinking, and I believe we've got to do both. So for us, it was yes, I need to feed people today to make sure they are not hungry and that they're not starving and the kids aren't going without to go to school to learn, et cetera. And we got to start saying, I don't want to become, you know, a 200 million pound food bank. You know, that's not the answer. Closing that gap with us will cost this community another $40 million, and we'll have to keep paying for that. What's the better solution? I believe starting the dialogue around that, starting the dialogue about breaking down silos, rebuilding communities from the inside out, asset-based community development modeling is what Bob talks about, the assets in that community. We've got to be willing. And lastly, we've got to make a commitment that it's about us stepping up to do that. If you view the food bank, or in Dale's analogy, the shelter board, one of the things we are that's not sometimes helpful is we're the comfort blanket. As long as the food bank has food and there's a space at the shelter, we all think things are good. That didn't end why somebody was homeless or why somebody was hungry. We've got to do that, and we've got to step into the deeper, tougher questions.
I will end up reiterating a lot of what has been said. I think we've got to create space for the conversation across what communities of people that haven't been in conversation for a while. And that's going to be difficult because at this point, the gulf between those two communities is pretty wide. So being able to even step into their shoes is going to require a real level of understanding. I think there's also, you know, I'm here as Catholic Social Services. I think our churches can play a role in this. What can they be but schools of compassion and schools of places where we are encouraged in our values and where community is built. I thought one of the most interesting theories that Sam Quiñones put forward in the book Dreamland, which is about the growing heroin epidemic in our midst, was that what is facilitating this is a breakdown in community, and it's happening across all levels. How do we rebuild that? We consider ourselves one another's keeper, and it's going to require time, and it's going to require some of those, the space that doesn't come easily on social service outcomes sheets. It's not going to be something that you can tick off relatively easily, but it's going to require the time and the space for us to have conversations and to facilitate those among our people. But I want to end with one phrase that I really liked from Bob's book, and it's just on page 4. And he says, I believe now, as I did when I wrote Toxic Charity, that the only effective charity is the kind that asks more from people served rather than being less. Asking for more sends an affirming message to the recipient that he or she also has something of value to offer. And I don't think that that's isolated to somebody that we serve. I think it's a part of what's expected of us. We've got to bring our A game to this conversation.
This is listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio, AM 820. Thanks for joining us today for this very special broadcast of the 2016 Catholic Social Services Poverty Summit. You heard from Lisa Schweitzer-Cortese, the moderator, and panelists David Bianconi, Representative Michael Curtin, Matthew Habish, and Rachel Lustig. You can download this Poverty Summit from the St. Gabriel website by going to stgabrielradio.com and going to the special features page of our radio archives. Thanks again for joining us today. God bless and have a great day.